that same year that I graduated from college and was on my way to play professional basketball overseas, I became a victim of gun violence. I was shot twice in my back during an armed robbery, and those bullets ended my basketball career. I was having my last doctor's appointment to remove the bullets out of my back. And I remember my doctor started to tell me a story of a young man from my community. This young man was 14 years old when he became a victim of gun violence, and my doctor saved his life. And as a result of that shooting, this young man at the age of 14 years old lost sight in his left eye. And the more details that my doctor shared about this young man, my heart just started beating faster and faster, because I realized he was describing the young man that shot me. He was released from the hospital just like I was, released back into that same community without any support, any mental health services to help him heal and deal with the trauma that he was experiencing. So I honestly believe that that young man's unaddressed trauma resulted in further victimization with me being shot. And so the cycle of violence in communities rips apart communities across the country. And at Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice, we're working to help change that.
Survivors of crime in communities hit hard by crime and incarceration did not express what often gets attributed to them, which is they want more punishment, long sentences, and increased incarceration. In fact, survivors communicated to us that they want prevention, they want healing, and they want investments in their communities to stop the root causes of crime.
A voice on the other end of the phone told me that my daughter had been murdered and that my grandson had been murdered. He was in kindergarten. Initially, I froze. I just froze when I was notified. And over time, I got to meet people that were engaged in restorative justice. It opened up for me an even bigger picture. We could make a difference. Mass incarceration doesn't work. It doesn't make us safer. It breeds more violence. We need to heal more than just the individuals and just the families. We need to heal communities. This, to me, is something that can happen.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. And we are back with our very special guest.
I am Renee Williams. I'm the executive director of the National Center for Victims of Crime.
Well, welcome back, Renee. And it's so good to talk to you about the National Center and the work that you're spearheading there. And I'm so happy to be part of it. And now... the Real Crime Profile team is part of it as well.
And we are delighted to have you all on board.
Great.
Well, when we're talking about victims, that's something that is very important to us, always putting victims at the center of everything we do. So let's jump back into the conversation, Renee, and you can tell us more about the work of the center. Maybe around, I don't know if you've finished telling us about statute of limitations, but certainly in California, I know with domestic violence, in particular, I was pretty shocked to find out that the statute of limitations for someone coming forward was 3 years, which is now being expanded to 5 years. But that still seems like a very short amount of time, particularly when someone's grappling with the trauma and the chaos. Is that an area at all that the center looks at?
Not within domestic violence, no. Our work in statute of limitations is primarily around sexual abuse, not only of children, but also of sexual assault cases. I think what a lot of people don't understand is the two justice systems, the criminal and civil justice system, are handled very differently in the United States. So when we talk, we're talking both about criminal justice statute of limitations and civil justice statute of limitations, which a lot of times the civil justice ones are much, much shorter.
That's the same in the UK. The two processes are very separate. The family justice system is actually shrouded in much more secrecy than the criminal justice system. But both are being exposed for major gaps and certainly not putting victims, and I'm going to say needs and safety, at the centre of decisions that are being taken. And the centre, you're doing work around reform, are you, with victims' voices at the centre of that? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We are doing a lot of work around reform of the prison system. And I think when we first started this, a lot of people wondered why. Why would a victims group be involved in looking at reforming the justice system? And one of the important things that we want everybody to know is we've done a lot of studies on this. We work with the MacArthur Foundation. We're part of a group called the Safety and Justice Alliance, working on the Safety and Justice Challenge. And really, when you ask victims what they want, by and large, they will say that they would prefer seeing their perpetrator get services and work on reform while in prison rather than having a longer prison sentence, which might seem a little counterintuitive, but it's really not when you understand that prisoners are going to be released from jail. Most sentences are not going to be life sentences. So to reduce the chance of recidivism, most victims want to see a lot more put into reform and education and services. The other thing that I think is really important for people to know is 90%, over under by a couple of percentage points, but 90% of people in prison report that they are victims of crime themselves. And usually that's probably some sort of childhood trauma, that they just never received the services to help them handle that. So they are now in prison and they are dealing with even more trauma and likely being traumatized within prison. And they're not getting the services. And you're just setting them up to fight an uphill battle when they're released, to not reoffend, to not go back in, unless you provide them services immediately.
Yeah, it's very clear that if our prisons are just holding cells and breeding grounds and crime universities, that all we're doing is putting out people who are more adept at committing crimes and less able to blend back into society. So if there is no actual rehabilitation going on in prison, all we're doing is creating a bigger and bigger and bigger culture of crime.
And I think in the end, you're not helping victims as part of that. You're not helping victims heal. That's not helping them move away from their victimization.
I just want to put a caveat in here. If we're talking about psychopaths, we have to bear in mind that there isn't any treatment for them. And why I say that is because there are lots of cases, and there's one in particular right now that I'm involved with, and his name is Cameron Hooker. He's in prison currently, and the judge, when he sentenced him, said that he should serve 104 years. However, there's a law in California that when you reach 62, then you can basically be eligible for parole. Now, this man, he abducted young girls, and in particular, one young girl, Colleen Stan, he kept in a box for 7 years, and he coercively controlled her, he abused her, he tortured her, he did the same to his wife, and he is coming up for parole next year. And what he has learned is that don't leave any witnesses behind. That's what he learned from the criminal justice process. He's never shown any responsibility, has no empathy, no remorse at all for what he has done, but yet he's still eligible for parole. So I do just want to say there are some caveats on cases. It's not just, you know, well, victims just don't want perpetrators to serve long sentences. There are those that need to be there because they are so dangerous, they shouldn't be let out.
No, and absolutely agreed. I think that I'm speaking more to the one-offs, but agreed that there are some people. So I'm often asked in this role, do I believe that anyone is beyond redemption? And my usual answer is, that's not my decision to make. That's between them and their God, whoever it is. But I do absolutely believe there are some people who we know scientifically will not change. And those people, it's not about punishment. It's about protecting society. So there are individuals that I completely agree.
If we can keep them out of society permanently, that's one thing. But if we can't, we need to at least try to get people to either learn, if they're amenable and capable of learning, how to avoid offending behavior, not just how to avoid being caught. And one of my biggest pet peeves about the justice system and about research that's done is this term recidivism, because we've talked about it before, but in child sex crimes, that means that the offender has to commit the crime, that that crime has to then be reported, that the person then has to be caught and arrested and convicted and sentenced, serve their time, get back out, offend again, and then be reported again and be arrested again and be convicted again. Now you finally have recidivism. But there's so many places along the way where that can fall apart, where the child, most of the time, the vast majority of times, will not report. And therefore, nobody even knows about hundreds, if not thousands, of other offenses that could have been committed. So it's just a very difficult, sticky situation when we talk about recidivism, because recidivism does not measure reoffending. It measures what the justice system manages to capture for the second time around.
And frankly, it measures what victims are comfortable coming forward with and how much victims are believed, which we still face a huge problem with in this country, is believing victims.
Absolutely. Right. But also taking seriously the things that happen to them. I mean, with the case I talked about, Cameron Hooker, he actually is believed from his first wife, Jan, that he abducted another girl before Colleen and he killed her, but he wasn't charged with murder. And they basically said, because they couldn't find her body, that they wouldn't charge him with murder, but they charged him with multiple other offences for Colleen, but they didn't charge him with the sexual offences because it was pled down and they took the death penalty off the table. So if the murder had been taken seriously, investigated seriously, if they had charged him, and as Jim said, it's only what they're charged for that is visible. And we know that lots of other things, particularly with a prolific offender like him and with others. And when you understand this case, when he abducts Colleen, he puts a box on her head called a head box to monopolize every part of her perception. Now, that's a skilled and very criminally sophisticated offender, everything that he did.
And him, sadistic.
Yeah, and very sadistic individual. That didn't just happen overnight. So there was a whole pattern of behavior beforehand, but his index offense is Colleen Stan, not for the other things that he did prior. It really is a very shocking case, by the way, and one that I still can't quite understand why taxpayers' money would be used for him to have a parole hearing when he's clearly, there's been no intervention. There's been no rehabilitation. There's been no responsibility taking. I know there's a blanket piece of research where people say, well, men, when they reach 62, are less dangerous. But who have you done that study on? Because I'm sure it doesn't include psychopaths. So right, these blanket statements or policies that come in can be very dangerous.
Renee, can you mention any specific cases that do drive you in that criminal justice reform?
We recently started working with Van Jones Group, the Dream Corps, which runs a program called Cut 50 Alliance. And we met two just tremendous people who are going to be speaking at our upcoming conference. One is named Lewis, and I'm not going to give his last name because I don't want to tell his story. But Lewis grew up in Connecticut. He was polyvictimization out the ears, basically. He was subject to abuse. He very much grew up on the streets. I believe his uncle and brother were both victims of gunshot violence, and he ended up going to prison himself for a gunshot charge. He shot some people, and there were a lot of other crimes. The beautiful story about Lewis is he worked very hard in prison and got degrees and really took advantage of all the services that were offered to him, and he's come out now and has become a tremendous voice for both victims of crime and for formerly incarcerated people. And the really beautiful part about his story, when the crime that he committed, he ended up shooting a little boy who was 5 and he was hit by a stray bullet. The little boy lived, but Lewis openly says, I was part of that the worst day of that kid's life. He's now a young man who's 27, and he and Lewis reconnected, and Lewis went to him and apologized and said he was sorry. And they now have this beautiful friendship, and Lewis has committed himself to getting this young man jobs, and he's helped him through his career path. So I think that's just a tremendous story of redemption. And I think also my aunt's own story of the failure of the system to help her has driven me. We tend in America to throw away people if they are not superlative. And that's not true just of formerly incarcerated people, but victims often. You only hear victim stories when the victim was superlative, and we don't pay attention to the rest. And I just don't think you should have to be superlative to have people care about what happens to you and care about your story.
For me, this house is kind of a house of horror.
She's the kidnap victim, once known as the girl in the box, imprisoned for 7 years in a wooden crate.
I did think I was gonna die. I was terribly claustrophobic. I was having such a hard time breathing.
Colleen Stan was 20 years old when she was picked up while hitchhiking in California by a man and his wife. Colleen says she was driven to this house. Sometimes she had this appalling device locked over her head. Other times she was held for 23 hours a day in the coffin.
I just cried out to God for his help and just said, please. I just felt so broken and so violated.
Colleen's abductor was a lumber mill worker, Cameron Hooker.
Cameron was torturing me one time. He had me hanging up suspended in the basement. And he came up next to me and he said, go ahead and scream, I'll cut your vocal cords, I've done it before.
After 7 years captivity, Colleen escaped from the clutches of her abductor. He was found guilty of kidnapping and rape and sentenced to 100 years. His wife was never prosecuted because she helped Colleen escape and also agreed to testify against her husband. Colleen says she has now rebuilt her life.
And now that so many years have passed, it's kind of like it was a whole nother lifetime, you know? And this is my new life.
So many victims feel so isolated and alone. And I don't think they would dream in a million years that there's a place like the National Center for Victims of Crime. I mean, I don't think it's on anybody's radar. So what do we do to get that message out there, get those resources out there?
Please go to our website. It is victimsofcrime.org. There are so many resources on there, and you can access it whenever you can confidentially. We've given the phone number for the hotline. Our other organization is victimbar.org, and that's the National Crime Victim Bar Association. We can refer folks to attorneys nationwide that will help them as well. But it is getting the word out that every victim does matter. And no matter what you've been told, because a lot of times, as we discussed earlier in the show, a control factor sets in and you're told you don't matter. You're told nobody cares and that there's no one there to help you. And that's just not true.
Yeah, that's great. And particularly if people find themselves in a situation and they need the advice of a lawyer, that could be incredibly helpful, because most people believe that lawyers cost a ton of money and they're for the wealthy, and regular everyday people don't get a chance to talk to them. But if the National Center can hook them up with a lawyer that can give them advice or get them representation, that can make their experience through the criminal justice system as victims of crimes and survivors of crimes, that can make it that much better.
We have so many children, actually, who are, again, child sex abuse victims who we've been able to connect to our attorneys. And not one part of this is good, but it is so touching to see a child holding an attorney's hand and saying, this is my lawyer. You know, when you have a 10-year-old saying, this is my lawyer, it's precocious and very, very touching.
Can I ask you about any research, since we brought up child sex victimization? I'd like to dig into child sex trafficking and anything that your organization knows about. I mean, we're talking about it so much in the media lately. There's so much misinformation about what's going on. Are there organized rings that are abducting children? And I mean, can you share anything that you know about that subject?
I'm limited on what I can share, but yes, there are absolutely organized rings. The interesting thing is that at the border where we are looking at separating parents from their children, what the Department of Homeland Security has seen is that oftentimes the adult that we are separating the child from may not be the parent. They are actually using the child for labor trafficking, not necessarily sex trafficking, but as drug mules. Wow. But I don't have specific numbers as to any of that. A lot of that's very hard. Just like child sexual abuse, it's very hard to prevent or get numbers on the front end for because it is so hidden and kept in such secret that it's only after. It's hard to do preventative work in that area.
But Renee, you're also probably in a position to help destroy some of the really harmful and extreme myths that are out there. For example, that there are devil worshiping cults that are trafficking millions of children, that the former Secretary of State Clinton is involved in a massive child porn sex trafficking ring, you know, all this other crap. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Let me dispel all of those myths. Those are not true. And going one step further with the Clintons, one of our attorney members for the Bar Association is Brad Edwards, and he is the original attorney who broke open all of the Epstein cases. And he's the one that really fought for the victims' rights in Florida, and he represents a majority of those victims. And Brad has gone on the record as saying he does not believe the Clintons had anything to do with Jeff Epstein's death, first of all, for that conspiracy theory. But even further, he genuinely does not believe that the Clintons did any ill on Lolita Island.
But I think it's important, and I think Laura will agree and Lisa will agree, to separate the Clintons because they're not the same person and they certainly don't have the same behavior or the same, well, let's say issues. But I don't think anybody at all thought that Hillary Clinton, even though I was one of the investigators who investigated her in the Whitewater investigation, I'll be the first one to say that I do not believe there has ever been a scintilla of evidence that she has ever been engaged in anything like child sex crimes, whether they're physical crimes or sexual crimes, period. She just has not been involved in anything like that. Bill has been certainly on the plane, the Epstein plane, much more than Hillary has. And Bill has definitely had sexual relationships with younger women, not underage women that I've ever known of, but he certainly has been very active in that area over the course of his life and marriage. But I have not ever gotten any information that Bill Clinton has engaged in sexual activities with minors. So I don't know if you've heard anything about that, but again, I just think it's important to separate the two of them and not lump them together because there's all sorts of conspiracies. And again, I did the Vince Foster equivocal death investigation and determined that he committed suicide. He was not murdered by the Clintons or anybody else at the White House. He was not dumped in Fort Marcy Park. He was actually profoundly depressed and really worried about his image as a person, as a lawyer. Not that the Clintons were completely uninvolved, because it was the situations that they were in legally that probably pushed him over the edge, that got him so depressed about the situation. But they personally had nothing to do with, they didn't kill him or encourage that or hide his death or anything like that at all. So it's just when people don't know, when there's a lack of information, all these conspiracy theorists move in and they come up with all this garbage that, you know, actually ends up hurting real investigations.
Exactly. It obscures. Exactly.
And I think, interestingly, America's obsession with true crime and how it's just proliferated, we get so many questions that you would normally think, and these are in presentations, these are requests from reporters that are just out of the norm and really inappropriate, that this obsession has really fueled conspiracy theories even more, to almost to the point of the absurd.
Can we talk a little bit more about some of the training that the National Center does?
Sure. We have a program called Project Safe Neighborhoods. It's one of our premier training programs. We work with about 5 different cities in training on different topics from community intimidation and retaliation, domestic violence, topics like that, where we are training prosecutors, police departments, and victim advocates how to both work together, how to address victims of crime, how to canvass neighborhoods correctly. And we do that through podcasts. We often go into the city, although not during COVID, but we will go in and we will hold full day conventions. The other training we do, and one of the largest training conferences in the nation, is our National Training Institute.
We need a positive populism, where people start coming together across these lines and just helping each other. And that's the work that I'm trying to do through the Dream Corps, which is where I get a chance to work. You know, I reached out to a guy a few years ago named Newt Gingrich. Newt and I had a TV show together called Crossfire, and we disagreed on every single point. In fact, the whole point of the show is that Newt and I don't agree on anything. But on the prison question, Newt, at a commercial break, said, "Why are you going so soft on prisons?" I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "You're going too soft. You're just talking about the racial issues." I said, "Well, it's a racial thing." He goes, "That's your thing. It's a racial thing. I get that. But as a conservative, I see prisons as a massive, failed government bureaucracy that's wasting a ton of money and having worse outcomes every year with no accountability. As a conservative, I see prisons as gobbling up people's rights and liberties. As a conservative, I see the prison system as offering no redemption. I'm a conservative Christian. Where's the second chance? People leave a physical prison, they go into a social prison. They can't vote, they can't get a scholarship. Why are you going so soft on the prison system? As a conservative, I'm about to come out stronger than you." And I said, "Where you been all my life?" You know. And we joined forces. And we started getting Republicans and Democrats in D.C. to work together on criminal justice.
Can we talk a little bit about diversity training?
We pride ourselves on being a very diverse staff, an extraordinarily diverse board. We've done a lot of diversity training because crime does not just happen to a certain set of the population, whether gender-based, whether race-based, everybody can be a victim of a crime. And so it's incredibly important for us and for our victim advocates to be able to address all populations in a culturally sensitive manner. So we do diversity training. And I believe that recognizing diversity within our communities is crucial to any victim advocate trying to assist victims, and that diversity training is just incredibly important.
Wasn't there sort of an issue with that training recently?
President Trump did sign an executive order that, in short form, discusses that we cannot discuss race theory if we are using federal funds. So no federal funding can go to discussing the fact that there is any difference between the races, or that there is a difference in how certain people need to be approached. So one of the things we look at when we do diversity training is we come from different experiences, and my experiences as a white woman might be very different from someone else's experiences. And so I need to be culturally aware of what they may have gone through. This executive order essentially says that we cannot acknowledge that, or we will not be federally funded.
Including with, for example, tribal cultures.
Exactly.
And any other cultures across the country.
Well, it's interesting because tribal cultures weren't specifically called out. And the executive order is very cautiously worded. And interestingly, the president actually has a national missing and indigenous women's task force that he has launched that is doing a lot of good work around that. He did put good people in place. So there is a focus on certain cultural differences, but not others. And I will be frank, we are still trying to swim through exactly what that executive order means.
We have listeners, as Laura said earlier, across the country and literally around the globe. And everybody who is a passionate listener of Real Crime Profile understands that our major focus is the victims of crimes and helping prevent those crimes in the first place, but also helping the people who have been victimized to become survivors and to thrive in their lives. So how can people that are listening, how can they help the National Center for Victims of Crime? What can they do?
I think one of the top things we look for is donations and the willingness to come and volunteer. We have a lot of different ways to volunteer, especially in the community, but donations are very helpful to us right now. As we talked about earlier, we are mostly federal funded, which means our funding goes in cycles that are usually about 3 years. I believe it was Lisa that brought up the Stalking Resource Center. That was a tremendous resource, but it was a federal grant and that money went away. So we were no longer able to maintain that. If we had donations, we'd be able to put money towards that. So we have tremendous programs that are hanging on by threads or that we know are concluding. And donations go a long way in helping us push those programs forward.
How would people donate?
If they go to victimsofcrime.org, we have an entire donation page, but it also discusses either becoming a corporate partner, how we look for volunteers and how you can volunteer with us. And a lot of the volunteering is great because you get to go out into the communities and talk to people. We mostly do it in DC because that's where we're based. But if we can get volunteers that want to be in other cities, we will fly to you and we will bring loads of brochures and help you out to get our message out there.
If you go to their website, you can click down and there's a membership, there's internship opportunities, volunteer opportunities.
Is there anything we haven't asked you about that you'd like to talk about regarding the National Center or your work?
No, I think the only thing that I would leave everybody with is if you're a victim, please reach out. Do not suffer in silence. You are worth it and we're here to help you.
Thank you. We really appreciate that. Renee, it's been great talking to you and thank you for coming on and helping to educate our audience about what the National Center for Victims of Crime does and the different resources that are out there and also the things that they can do to help. And anybody could help spread the word wherever you are across this globe. We're all trying to fight crime. We're all trying to prevent victims from becoming victims in the first place. And if they are victimized, we want to help them become survivors and thrivers. So thank you very much, Renee, for helping us do that at Real Crime Profile.
Thank you.
Well, till next time, everybody, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the exonerated five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, or counseling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.